post Thanksgiving show, folks. Yeah, it's we're all turkeyed out, cranberry sauce, all kinds of good red wine. Some of us get some champagne. Hope you're hanging in there. Hope you've recovered from the turkey day. America is the big turkey world. Thanksgiving has happened. It's over with. And we move on. Hey, Earth Ancients is sponsored by Gaia. And for the next couple of weeks, actually for the next couple of months into the new year, they have a special program. And if you go to gaia.com/Earth Ancients, you can get this new program for 99 cents. First month's 99 cents, and after that's about $9. They have hundreds of first cut new release on pyramids, on UFOs, on ancient aliens, on everything, wellness, spirituality. And when you support Gaia, you support Earth Ancients. And to go to the site, again, it's Gaia, GAIA.com/Earth Ancients. They got hundreds of programs to check out. So they are sponsoring us. So check them out. I mean, it's just so much. And what a great deal just to start. Hey, 99 cents, check it out. If you don't like it, jump off. But you'll love it because a lot of people on this show are on Gaia. It's a great program. I have to laugh because I was watching CNN the other day, and I mean, Black Friday has become a joke. People are fighting over toys. I mean, there was a mass fight in Chicago, a massive store fight at Walmart. People were like crashing through plate glass windows, fist fights in the middle of the malls over toys. Toys. I'm like, what the hell is this all about? And I mean, I don't get it. Stay home. Use Amazon. If it's not on Amazon, it's probably not. I mean, come on. Amazon has everything. Make it easier on yourself. And if you're a Prime member of Amazon, you get the shipping for free. I just don't get it. I mean, wow. Just to see people fighting. It's like I keep saying, it's like a hangover from Thanksgiving. People are like going nuts. I mean, I don't really know what could be so amazing that you have to go to a store to buy it and save a few bucks. I mean, isn't there a way to do it online? We're the internet culture here. We should be able to order it online ahead of time. So there must be something about getting out, going to the store after Thanksgiving. That must be the big deal. It's a day off. That's what it is. It's a holiday. So it's kind of weird. I'm just trying to figure it out. Hey, I got a really amazing photograph was sent to me of Machu Picchu. And if you haven't been there, I have not been there. It's thousands of feet above sea level. It was built up on a hillside, mountainside, actually. And this new image that we have is on the Facebook page. Go to Facebook, Earth Ancients, go to group. It's of a walkway on the side of a building. And I titled it, Don't Look Down. And you got to check this thing out. You can actually see all the way down to the river, which is probably, I don't know how many, couple of thousand feet easy. I mean, probably more, a hell of a lot more. And how they designed this city is just amazing. There's walkways on the edge of buildings that basically if you step off wrong, you're dead. you're just going to be, you know, you're going to be part of the rocks down below. So check that out. The other thing is I've been still picking up and getting these 360-degree images of various parts of Egypt. And one of our members sent us a image of the interior of the Great Pyramid, the Grand Gallery. And again, this is one of these very fancy cameras that shoots a complete image, this top to bottom. And they walk in a circle. And it is one of the most amazing images I've ever seen. The more I see these images, the more I want to get one of these cameras. Somebody sent me an email. The lowest end price on one of these cameras is about $400. But somebody else told me that you can get one as an app on your phone. I think you probably got to get the camera to get the full 360-degree spectrum. But anyhow, check out this photo. It's on our Facebook page, the Great Pyramid, the Grand Gallery. It's the part of the entrance. You walk through the entrance, and you start going up this long stairway. And the reason it's interesting is these are massive stones weighing thousands and thousands of tons. It gives you a perspective of the interior of the Great Pyramid. The other thing that's quite interesting is we just don't know what the use of this pyramid was. You know, people say, well, the Egyptologists want us to think it's a crypt. It's a burial chamber. But there's something else going on there. There's certain specific design. We've had many, many people on the show talking about the purpose of the Great Pyramid. My favorite, of course, is Chris Dunn, who says it's an engine of some kind of a machine. And we just don't know. But this is a real close-up look at this grand gallery. Something you should definitely check out. Always check out the Facebook page. Each week we have a ton of new images. We have articles. And don't forget to sign up on the new website. The new website is earthancients.com. When you register, you'll get the newsletter. We're starting to work on the newsletter for December. And we'll have all kinds of updated information. We're giving away a lot of articles that are coming to us by different authors. So please check that out.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
And today we have the director of the Cydonia Institute joining us. George Haas has been with us before, and he has some interesting news on some new ruins that have been found on the surface of Mars. George, how are you doing today?
Hey! You know, I just found your phone number and got on the air here just in time.
Well, see, it all works out for a reason, fella.
That's right.
It's all part of it.
It's all part of
synchronicity. Hey.
I was downstairs eating lunch, and I heard the phone ring, and I said, I recognize that voice.
Yeah. Well, for
so
all
here
of
we
you,
are.
Those of you who are listening, I called George and said, dude, it's time to get on the show to talk about this new ruin. So we had you on approximately a year ago, George, and I think that time you were talking about the Eye of Horus on the surface of Mars.
Right.
And now this is something new. You are calling it a step pyramid. Why don't you tell our audience a little bit about where it's located and some dimensions and other details on this new discovery?
Well, it's fairly large. It's probably a mile wide. It's very large, just like a lot of these formations that we're finding on Mars. They were constructed at an enormous scale.
Right.
And it's in the Cerberus region of Mars, and this was taken in a Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter image that was just released back in May. So this is a new release. This
okay.
is a formation that a friend of mine, Keith Laney, who I've known for years, probably going on 15, 20 years now, and he runs the Hidden Mission website. And
okay.
he had found this early on, I think, in a Mars Reconnaissance CTX image, and he requested that NASA take a close-up image of this, which they did. I mean, it's dead center if you look at the strip.
Oh, this is NASA. For some reason, I thought this was the European Space Agency's camera on their satellite. So this is NASA.
No. This is NASA's Mars. This is one of those real high-resolution. I mean, you can go into the the JPEG 2000 process and really look real up and, you know, close to the surface here and look at the type of formations that are making up this mound. You can actually see the layering. So it's a very high resolution image.
Tell our audience about the surface. This is one of the most unusual images I've seen. I don't know. This must be a new camera that they're using, because you can actually see the surface features on this pyramid. And I don't know, was it you or Dr. Brandenburg wrote something about the what is the actual texture? What is that odd looking texture? What did you guys come up with?
Well, Brandenburg has made a lot of speculation about what a lot of these formations are made of, but it has a lot of layering. Geologists would probably say this is just sediment rock that you're seeing going down the side, but when you look closer, it does look like uniform construction.
Okay.
And the interesting thing about this formation, it has that ramp at the top there. If you look at the top of the form, if the listeners want to go to the, I guess if they want to see the image, on Cliff's ancient aliens, or not, what's it, Earth Ancients?
Earth Ancients, yeah. I think I posted it, didn't I? I can
right,
repost
so if,
it.
The listeners want to go to his Facebook page, it's right there on his Facebook page, or they can go over to the Sidoni Institute discussion board, just look that up on Al Gore's internet. And you'll be able to get a link to the discussion board. And what we found is this is a very interesting formation. There's this rectangular platform, and it's got another step type of formation at the peak, almost looking like a very three-dimensional eye shape coming up, which is basically just the layering of the temple that's at the top of this. And doing a little research, I thought this formation looked very familiar. And if you go to the American Indian Mound Builders, some of their pyramids that were built in Georgia, if you go to the Etowah Mound, we do a comparison of that on our the Sidoni Institute discussion board, and we have a side-by-side picture of them, and it's pretty amazing how similar the construction is, even that rectangular platform at the top.
The funny thing about this is, though, that and Brandenburg's talked about this when I've had him on the show, and I've had other people talk about it. The estimated age of a lot of these ruins isn't it in the hundreds of thousands of years, or even a million years possible? I mean, that's what Brandenburg says. And when I think of that, and if that's the true age of these ruins, I mean that they're in a state of real decay.
Right. A lot of these formations, we can just speculate how old they are. My time frame is a little different than Dr. Brandenburg's. William Saunders, my co-author, another member of the Society for Planetary SETI Research, we believe these formations are probably a lot more recent than one would think. We think these formations were built after Mars was a dead planet.
Okay.
And I think they're a lot more recent. And we're thinking probably between 50 and 100,000 years old.
Okay. That's kind of interesting.
So that's a lot different than what Brandenburg's thinking.
So Brandenburg's
thinking these formations were there when Mars was destroyed by that nuclear war. We're thinking these were built after.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, it's
just
so
fascinating. But there's only one way to find out is to go there, you know.
Yeah. Well, hey, maybe the Chinese will get there before we will. We'll get some real clear... I mean, they're sending a rover pretty soon, so.
But Cliff, the interesting thing is that a lot of people that we're doing this research with, the argument no longer is, are these artificial? The argument is, you know, how old are they? Which is
exactly. Well, you won't hear NASA say that there's anything there. That's the problem, though, is that they're. I mean, there has to be some real solid revelations. They have to go, okay, look, we found this pyramid, and it looks like this and that, and I mean. I just don't see it. I mean, I just don't see them revealing that. But maybe it'll just be so much in their face that they have to kind of disclose what's going on. You can only hope, right?
Right. Well, the NASA scientists are looking at this more scientifically, and they're looking at this more as a geologist would. And everything they look at has a geological explanation. They don't even dare to think that anything up there is artificial. They're all convinced that whatever odd, NASA speaks out of both sides of their mouth sometimes. they'll say that, well, we can't compare Martian formations to Earth artificial formations because there's a different geological processes that go on Mars. However, if you read science papers that are talking about Mars formations, and they use NASA images and they talk about the geology, they're comparing the geology in most every one of these papers with Earth geology. So you can't say at one point that, oh, this is a different exotic type of mechanisms that are going on Mars, and then you're having scientists working on geological papers about Martian formations and comparing them to Earth geology. So it's you can't have it both ways.
That's strange. Well, listen, thanks for joining us real quickly. We're going to have, just for our listeners, our program next week will feature George, Dr. Brandenburg, and a couple of other people who are talking about the ruins of Mars. That's our special program next week, so stay tuned for that. That's the first Saturday, December the 5th. So we'll have you back, George. We want to get the details and really spin into some serious discussion on these ruins.
All right. Do I have one more second to leave a little teaser out there?
Oh, please do. Yeah, go ahead.
When we come on next week with Cliff, we just had a science paper accepted at the Journal of Space Exploration, and it'll feature the Keyhole Formation, which has made its rounds around the Internet. So I'm sure some of the listeners will be familiar with that. And the exciting news is we just had a real science paper published, which was discussing that formation. So we'll highlight that next week.
We'll definitely want to hear more about that next week.
I'll send
George,
you
thanks
some,
for stopping in for a few minutes. Appreciate it.
All right, I'm glad I found your phone number just in time.
Hey, worked out. Good job.
All right,
thanks,
man. Thanks for having me on.
All right, take care. So that will be next week's program. The ruins of ancient ruins of Mars is a feature that we'll have. A couple of special guests will be on the program also. So stay tuned for that. Fascinating. As you guys know, I am totally into Mars being inhabited by an ancient race. I've just keep seeing more and more and more evidence. And in fact, when the European Space Agency got involved, they were using a camera that had such clarity. In fact, they even used a stereophonic camera, which made things very, very clear. It just kind of blew the roof off of any negative consideration for ruins. Actually, it enhanced the idea of ruins. So today we're talking about NASA. In 1958, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration was created as a result of the two countries, the Soviet Union and the Americans, going in developing a space race, which started with Sputnik 1. The Americans would later develop Explorer 1, which is their version of a satellite. We've come to consider NASA as the top space agency, and it's been funded in the trillions of dollars to produce not only rockets and satellites, but also a variety of different programs, from the first manned program, the Mercury program, to the multiple programs in the Apollo. But has NASA been up and up with us? Have they actually given us the details of their research? My guest today is Mike Barra. We've had Mike on a number of times, and he's written a new book called Hidden Agenda, NASA and the Secret Space Program. And I just finished this book, and it's quite unique. Mike, as you know, is the co-author of Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA. And we had on a couple of times, we had him on for Ancient Aliens on the Moon. And of course, my favorite was the two books, Ancient Aliens on Mars 1 and 2. Mike, how you doing today?
I'm doing good, Cliff. It's interesting. I was the Eye of Ra formation you guys were just talking about is something I put in Ancient Aliens on Mars 2 and talked about it extensively. So if there's a new picture, I just went to George's site. It's not very clear where to find those images. I wish I could find them. I don't see them anywhere. So
you got to scroll down. Actually, I hear what you're saying. It's like it's not front and center. I think it there's a feature if you punch in new Mars image, it scrolls down to it. But you may have to I may have to pick it up and move it up to the top of the page and lock it in.
Oh, is it on your Earth Ancients page or?
No, it's on my Facebook page, but you got to scroll down and get it. It's hidden in there. I posted it like earlier in the week. So.
Okay. Well, while we're talking, I'll go do that. Okay. Yeah. NASA's hidden agenda, advertising me on the show. Okay. just doing this. While, you know, radio is always it's always great to do radio where you're like describing what you're doing on your computer. That's always the best radio, right, for people listening.
Exactly. So, yeah.
Yeah. Now I'm scrolling down. Now I see Cliff's page. Oh, there's a Sphinx. Anyway, keep going.
You know,
while I'm looking at that.
The biggest problem with Facebook is that, you know, I mean, it takes
a
gallery on there, but
it's
like anything else. Each time you post something, it pushes everything else down. So
yeah.
But anyhow, let's talk about this book.
Well, I was going to say, truthfully, if it were up to, you know, I mean, if I reposted every lost little animal I'd like to put on my Facebook page, I'd have... You know, you'd have to go down 20 steps to find anything to do with aliens or anything. So, yeah, it's kind of
I think what I'm going to do, though, is I'm going to start adding a section to my website. I just launched a website a few weeks ago, earthancients.com, and have this week's photo or a group of photos there so I can talk more about it. Because you make a good point. I reference Facebook a lot because I just get a ton of people sending me photographs, and it's a great place to put those. But, you know, the only way to keep a photo up is to pin it. You can pin a photo, and it kind of is at the top, and it doesn't move. So, anyhow, get a chance. Yeah, check that out. I might even have Richard on this program next week. We have to find out if he's available, but...
can you find him? Because I haven't been able to find him lately. I had to ask Paul Davids for his phone number at the Laughlin event, Paula Harris's Laughlin event a couple weeks ago. So
someone said he was in Europe, but I don't know. When he leaves the country, it's tough. But
he's a hard man to get a hold of these days.
He is tough to get a hold of. Yeah. So we do have Dr. John Brandenburg, so that should be interesting, and of course George, and then a couple other people. So we'll see.
Oh yeah, say hi to. To John for me. He's a great guy. I've just met him once. We had a great discussion while we were shooting Ancient Aliens last year. It was really great. So,
Well, maybe we'll have you on.
Don't agree with him at all, but wonderful guy.
Okay. I hear you. Hey, so this new book on NASA, it's almost like you took a page from Dark Mission and just spun it a little bit and pushed it out. Is this kind of a post Dark Mission book, because there is a great deal on there. It doesn't really relate to Ancient Aliens on the Moon and Mars, except for a little bit. You do touch a little bit, but this is actually some deep background material. What was the launching point for this new book?
Well, it really didn't have anything to do with Dark Mission, although I think if there had been a second Dark Mission, it would have been something like this book. We were talking about doing a secret space program book, but at the time, I didn't feel like Richard had enough evidence to justify a book, and I think there's barely enough evidence to justify a book right now. But what I wanted to do, what I was thinking with this book, it's by the way, it's called Hidden Agenda, NASA and the Secret Space Program, and unfortunately, there ended up being a little bit less of NASA than I would have liked in the book, but it is basically about the secret space program. But what I thought was, look, there's all these people out there making all these claims. There's people claiming they jumped through teleporters to go to Mars with Barack Obama in the 1970s and all this stuff. And there's people making claims about, you know, the secret space program, secret platforms to, you know, fight off the aliens in a war and all this stuff. And I thought, well, you know, what there isn't out there that I could find is there isn't anybody that has any really solid evidence that there is a secret space program. Like, what is the actual evidence that this exists other than a few people in the UFO community spouting off about it? Because somebody in the quote inside, some insiders told them that this thing exists. And so what I wanted to do is go back, because I knew there was some anti-gravity research that had happened in the 1950s. I wanted to go back and look at what really was the solid evidence for that. And kind of by a stroke of luck, you know, Gaia hired me to do some writing for a show that they did called Deep Space. And it allowed me to do some background research for this book. So,
fantastic.
I was able to dig into this and find out that there was what was there, what was solid, what could I put my finger on, and that's how it all started. I thought, well, I'm just going to do a book about what evidence there really is that a secret space program actually exists. So that's
yeah.
how it got started for me.
Yeah, it's got a lot of great material. One of the early parts of the book gets into the history of what I'll call remarkable flying craft. And what's really of particular interest is the, for some reason, there was a great interest in zero gravity or craft that defied gravity and during the Second World War. And it seems like the Nazis were involved in a lot of advanced flying craft. I know that they had the flying wing and they had the first jet, which they didn't get going. But can you talk a little bit about some of their really advanced, perhaps anti-gravity craft that may have got its start there, but didn't get completed, or maybe it did?
Well, yeah. What's fascinating is you look at the state of German aviation technology at the end of World War II, and it was dramatically ahead of the U.S. Mm-hmm. They had the ME-262, the world's first operational jet fighter, and quite honestly, if Hitler had not been such an idiot and not been so stupid, if he had manufactured this as a defensive fighter to shoot down Allied bombers, the Germans could have probably completely put a stop to daylight bombing of their industrial facilities, and they might have actually been able to keep up their industrial capacity to the point that they could have kept going with, you know, on the war. They could have kept manufacturing tanks and ammunition and everything they needed for the war, and probably could have resulted in some sort of favorable armistice for Nazi Germany rather than a complete and utter defeat. But as Chuck Yeager put it so eloquently at one point, fortunately, Hitler was an idiot, and he insisted they put bombs on these jet fighters and drop a 500-pound bomb on the Allies, which did, of course, nothing. So they were way ahead in terms of that technology. They were developing and had completely developed a flying wing design, the Horton HO-229, which a full-scale wood mock-up of which was actually captured after the war, and there's several photographs of it. And, you know, it's an interesting story in the book where I'm going to make an argument that, in fact, that's what Kenneth Arnold saw. His first famous UFO sighting was not a UFO at all, but they were actually a test squadron of these HO-229s. But to get back to your original question, then of course, Farrell has documented quite well in The Brotherhood of the Bell and Reich of the Black Sun, two of his great books, on this subject. And that was a very, very highly advanced, I think it's a kind of an anti-gravity reactor. It's like the engine for what would become the Hanenbaus, Nazi flying saucers. And, this thing used counter-rotating magnetic fields, very heavy spin, highly spun magnetic plates with a little bit of red mercury mixed in, and ended up creating an anti-gravity effect that the Bell supposedly had on everyone that came in contact with it. So, you know, the interesting thing is, as I got into the story, was that this German fascination with flying craft didn't just start, you know, at the time of Nazi Germany. It went all the way back to the early 1800s.
Right.
When there was a secret organization in Silesia, what was then Prussia, that it looks like sent some engineers to America to do some anti-gravity research.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So,
now,
you know,
I've seen,
it went way, way back.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because 20 years ago, when I was doing conferences, Whole Life Expo, we had a couple of guys, and I can't remember this one guy. He was like Eastern Europe, and he was so into the Nazi saucers. He actually had actual photographs that were taken, and I could never figure out if they were doctored, photoshopped. Of course, 20 years ago, Photoshop was in its basic
infancy.
State.
Yeah.
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 And they actually showed these ships with tank guns underneath them.
Yep, I'm looking at that. I'm looking at one of those images right now. Yeah,
are you?
Well, you know, I'll say this about those is that, you know, I have talked extensively to my publishers, David Hatcher Childress. I talked to him very extensively, and he believes these photographs are real. He says he's researched them over the years. He's been looking at them since the beginning. He's seen original copies of them, and he's pretty well convinced that a lot of these photographs are actual for real photographs of Nazi flying saucers.
Well, then they did develop some form of anti-gravity propulsion then. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's the conclusion that I come to in Hidden Agenda in the book, is that the Bell was an outgrowth of this very, very early research by, for want of a better term, a secret society called NIMSA, which nobody really knows what it stood for, but it may have stood for the National Exploratory Airship Program Office. And it was basically founded by wealthy Prussian industrialists who were looking at the ancient texts, like the stories about the Vimanas and the Maharathabada, however you pronounce that.
Yeah. Exactly.
And they were fascinated by these, but they couldn't really do the research in secret in Germany. So they started sending people to America. And one of them was a gentleman named Charles Delschau, who came from Prussia to the United States. Found his way to Houston, Texas, and then went to Sonora, California in the mid-1800s, where he spent 10 years and was part of something that's known as the Sonora Air Club. And when he returned to Houston, after supposedly they had made a breakthrough, they claimed that they had made a breakthrough, they found a fuel, an anti-gravity fuel that they called N/B gas, that they claimed that had allowed them to create lighter-than-air airships or to defy gravity. And then he made his way back to Houston. And, of course, at the time that this happened, it's fascinating that when he got back, he started making all of what I would call today production illustrations of flying ships that they had developed and theoretically built and experimented with. And then in 1896-97, this wave of airship sightings starts in the western U.S., and it starts basically in Sacramento, right near Sonora, California. And then the sightings kind of make their way back across the United States, back towards Prussia. So what I conclude happened is that these engineers were sent by NIMSA to this very remote area of the western United States, which is still incredibly remote. That's why we have Area 51 and other secret bases, S4, out in California, Nevada, Arizona, is because there's nothing there. And you can do extensive research on flying vehicles, you know, in secret. And then I think that they made a breakthrough, and they then built some craft, and they flew them back to Prussia. And that became the root of the German, the German high advanced aviation technology that eventually led to the Nazi Bell, which was, for all intents and purposes, an anti-gravity reactor.
So you actually talk about Charles Delschau, and you show some of his photos. And as an engineer yourself, you think they're somewhat legit. You actually show some photos of the Aero.
These are what we would call production illustrations. Basically, they're cutaway views of aircraft that I think were actually designed and probably built and tested. And once they had this breakthrough discovery of this NB gas, this anti-gravity fuel, they were able to get these things to work. And, you know, I mean, you had to remember that the state of technology at that time was extremely primitive. The steam train engine had barely been developed. And it took him another 40 years after his time in Sonora for them to actually build these airships. But then I think these are definitely responsible for the airship flap of the great airship flap of the late 1890s. And I think that these were these craft that were taken back to Germany. And I just believe that in Silesia in Germany, which is right where they found the test rig for the Nazi Bell, you know, another half century later, that's where all the developmental work came on, all the very exotic physics technology that the Germans were developing. And that led directly to the Nazi flying saucers.
Well, let's talk about that. So we know that Wernher von Braun, who was a Nazi, was rescued along with hand-picked scientists. I guess those guys were working on the V-2s.
Yeah.
Which eventually would he'd be working with NASA to develop the Saturn rocket, which is an extremely powerful rocket that lifts off not only satellite, but all the man program.
Yeah.
Do you believe he was also working on a alternative propulsion system? Was that perhaps an idea that he maybe have brought with him?
I don't know, and but I don't think so. And a couple of my other books, in The Choice and in some of my Moon and Mars books, what I think is that there were engineers were at the back end of this. They were not really part of the theoretical physics involved with these very, very advanced technology programs. So the programs that Hans Kammler was working on at that supposed rubber plant in Silesia that Joe Farrell talks about. And what I think is that von Braun sort of accidentally came across this advanced physics in the late 1950s when Explorer 1 was launched. And it ended up in an orbit some 600 miles farther up than it should have. And it took him years, really, of launches and misses where they actually tried to, for instance, fly a Ranger spacecraft into the moon to basically just hit the moon and crash on it. And they missed it by 38,000 miles, give or take, 18 times the diameter of the moon. You know, how do you miss the moon by 18 times its own diameter? It's basically impossible. And what happened was he eventually figured out that that rotation added energy into propulsion systems. And I think that once he figured that out, he kind of had his own plan for getting to the moon. But, you know, it's interesting because what I say in the book, what I say in Hidden Agenda is that there were two secret space programs that kind of ran in parallel. And the way I set it up is that there was one that the intelligence agencies that were an offshoot of the early OSS and CIA, I think they had their own program based on captured Nazi technology and based on probably crashed flying saucers that have been retrieved by the U.S. government. And the intelligence agencies, National Security State, I think is what Richard Dolan calls it. They developed their own, and then they tried to cut JFK out of it when he came into office. So I think he said, you know, F you, I'm going to launch a public program to the moon, which was NASA. But behind that public program was a second parallel secret space program. And I think their objective was to get to the moon, retrieve the alien technology from the moon, bring it back to Earth and reverse engineer it on their own. And I think that's the conclusion I reached. It's kind of extraordinary because that's not where I thought I would end up when I started the book, but that's where the research took me. So that's kind of to answer
book,
that question in a roundabout way. That's what I think happened.
Yeah. The book's fascinating. You get into World War II reports of, you don't talk a lot about it, but the Foo Fighters, these UFOs be seen over battlefields and flying during bombing runs and stuff like that. If those were Nazi test vehicles, that must have scared the hell out of the Allies to see that kind of a craft flying close to bombing. I mean, they must have thought it was all over when they started seeing those things in the air.
Well, I would think so, because they certainly displayed technology far beyond anything that had been seen in modern times, including jet aircraft and flying wings, which would have been extraordinary technology for the day. But they were way beyond that. And a lot of them seemed to be like balls of energy, too. It was kind of weird. And I think what that is that those are actually vehicles that were producing some sort of electrostatic field as they moved through the atmosphere. It was an early effect of the flying saucers. And at the time, they were probably unarmed and, like you say, very experimental. But, you know, I think all you need to know about whether or not we consider this stuff to be genuine or something to be concerned about is that you look at the movement of the U.S. Army, especially Patton's Third Army in at the end of World War II. And, you know, again, as Farrell points out in his two books, this area called Silesia, which is now in Poland, but at the time was Germany, Prussia, where they had this massive power plant and factory that was developing the Nazi Bell and other hyper exotic weapons and anti-gravity technology, was sort of in the southeast of Berlin. And when Patton and his Third Army crossed the Rhine near Remagen in 1945, you know, the logical thing to do at that point would be to go for Berlin. If you go straight to Berlin through the Ruhr area there, across the Elbe River and straight and capture Berlin, you end the war. You end Nazi Germany. You put an end to the whole thing. You right. Politically, you beat the Russians to Berlin. You have won the war and put an end to it. But instead of doing that, they ordered him to the southeast, basically a direct double pincer movement toward, guess where? Silesia and this secret power plant, secret facility where they were developing the technology. So the Allied generals at the top obviously mm-hmm. considered these secret weapons facilities to be far more important than the political goal of capturing Berlin, to the point that it actually cost them, the Western Allies, a chance to beat the Russians to Berlin. And we ended up having to split right. up the running of Berlin. So to me, when you look at that, it's like it's obvious what the Army High Command and everybody else thought was the most important target, and the most important target was this power plant where they were developing all these super weapons.
Do we know when he got over there if they actually retrieved anything? And was that the beginning where Warner wasn't there, von Braun wasn't there, he was somewhere else?
No, he was captured along the way, though. But he was captured along the way at Peenemünde, so he was
okay.
He was part of that, but. We don't know for a fact that they actually captured anything there, although there are records that Patton sent a sizable reconnaissance force into the area that was subsequently destroyed. And it's really interesting because Patton kind of said, that was my biggest mistake of the war. And, we got too far ahead of ourselves. But it was obvious that he was under incredible pressure to get in there and find out what was there. And I guess the story that's really fascinating is what happened to them and what did they face there, and
right.
who ended up with the weapons. It looks like Kommler, absconded with the bell and the plans for it, and looks like maybe went to South America and then on to Antarctica. And of course, there's some people who believe that the Germans ultimately, sold the whole thing to the United States in return for. Kind of building their own Fourth Reich here in the U.S., which is, that's an interesting theory. It's not one I concur with, but it
Let's
is a
stay
theory.
Let's clear so. Politics, please. We're dealing with some new stuff right now. One of the most fascinating aspects of your book, Mike, and Hidden Agenda, is the reports of ET-run UFOs and reverse engineering. And of course, Roswell, New Mexico is the most famous downed craft, but you get into
right.
quite a bit of information. And I want you to talk a little bit about somebody who I find is not only extremely revealing in your book, which would be behind a secret space program, but who actually verifies that we had quantum leaps in our science and technology, and that's Colonel Philip Corso, and he wrote a book called
mm-hmm.
The Day After Roswell. Can you talk a little bit about
right.
his importance? And, because I don't think a lot of people understand just how revealing this book is. And of course, he wrote it, and shortly after he wrote it, he died for may have been mysterious reasons, or he might have been natural. But anyhow, talk about Corso.
Well, I think Corso's book is really super critical in terms of understanding the whole UFO phenomenon, because in essence, he says that there were more than one crash besides Roswell, but the technology that was retrieved from these crashes was put out into the private U.S. private sector, industrial sector, for reverse engineering and development. And he says he knows this is true because he's the guy who did it. He's the guy who actually distributed that technology. He knew very well where it came from. And the thing about Corso is he did work for Eisenhower's National Security Council. He was on the National Security Council, which are the closest
yeah.
national security advisors to the president. They're the ones who give him, they're kind of a rival organization to CIA and some of the other organizations, but they're responsible for keeping the president informed about issues of the highest national security. And there's no question he worked there. There's no question he had great credibility. It's kind of sad because, in the UFO community, a lot of times when somebody new comes along, we have a tendency to kind of eat them alive. And there's a lot of people that don't like Corso, or they're jealous of the information he put out or whatever. But it's like, mm-hmm. I, as I dug into him, I found his, his credibility to be kind of difficult to impugn. And, you know, I just found that he's a very solid, credible guy. I do have a chapter in there on the whistleblowers, the people that I think are the ones who've been on the inside. And, you know, he's the one who basically said he gave the transistor to Bell Labs and that they were subsequently able to develop the transistor. And the reality is a transistor changed. It changed the world technologically. It enabled the ultimate creation of the personal computer and these smartphones. And it was a really dramatic change. And you know, there's people that say that, oh, well, Bell was already working on a transistor. But if you really dig into it, they were 10 years behind where they ended up when they suddenly just said, hey, we have a transistor.
Right.
So, you know, it's like there was a sudden leap in the technology. And, you know, there's other people that support what Carso has said. I mean, if you look at Dr. Hermann Oberth, who was actually Wernher von Braun's mentor, von Braun was his engineer. You have to understand that the way these things work is you have the theoretical physicists who come up with the wild, crazy ideas, and then you have the engineers that are able to turn them into something practical. And von Braun was his protege, his engineer. But he said, you know, in several interviews, he said, you know, when they asked about the advanced state of German technology, he said, we cannot take credit for our record advancement in certain scientific fields alone. We've been helped. And when he was asked who helped him, he said the people of other worlds. And, you know, flat out, basically just, he flat out said that in the interview. And then in another interview, he was talking about flying saucers, and he said, it's my thesis that flying saucers are real and they're spaceships from another solar system. And there's no doubt in my mind that these objects are interplanetary craft of some sort. And myself and my colleagues are completely confident they don't originate in our solar system. So he was another guy who, Mike Corso, came flat out and said, we got help from the aliens. So,
yeah.
You know, I think that there's definite leaps forward, and Corso is one of those guys that you know, he's telling you the story. He's trying to tell you the truth. This is what I did. This is who I
mean,
worked for.
He had to give up his security clearance to open his mouth the way he did. I mean, you've worked in aerospace engineering. I mean, there's certain, I don't want to say black projects, but things that are secret, top secret. And in this book, he basically says there were downcraft. They took what they could that was survivable, and his job was to give specific scientific labs parts of this craft to try to figure out what they were and then reverse engineer this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and this gets into fiber optics, the transistor, which is what you talked about. But there's other things that we don't really know about that he may have given to various science labs that basically spawned an entire industry, which is fascinating.
I mean, lasers apparently came from these developments.
Right.
So, there's all this stuff, that came out of these crash flying saucers. And like you say, there probably are other technologies which we do not know anything about that also were part of this.
Right. Now, this leads to the next part of this book, and for those of you listening, this is a fascinating part of Mike's book.
Come on.
Well, this is part that I didn't know about, and it's an American development of what is called an ARV, an alien reproduction vehicle.
Right.
And Mike actually goes into quite a bit of detail, and he actually shows one of these craft. Well, first of all, they are saucer-shaped, very rudimentary, though, very bulky-looking, very heavy. But Mike, talk a little bit about one of these reverse-engineered crafts, ARV. I find those fascinating. Never heard of them.
Well, I think, you know, the thing is this ARV, I suspect this comes from sort of the second parallel space program, the von Braun program, but it could also be a very, very early development of the NB gas concept. Because what's interesting about the ARV is that, first of all, the ARV, just for people who don't know the story, there was a gentleman named Mark McClandish who was supposed to go to an air show at I think it was Edwards Air Force Base, and he couldn't go. So one of his buddies went instead, and his buddy said, when I got there, there was this, I got in with this group that was taken to the second separate VIP area. And in this VIP area behind these curtains, there were these flying saucers, and they were sitting there floating off the concrete floor of the bunker or the hangar, and they were making no sound. And then they showed us videotapes of these things shooting straight up into the air at high speed and making impossible turns and all this stuff. And the interesting thing about them is that when you look at the you look at cutaway diagrams of what he said he saw, because there was one apparently with a pie section of it cut out, and he said there were these nice canisters on the floor, all sort of lined up in a spiral and around the floor of the craft, and there were a couple of pilot seats for normal sized pilots up above, and that led him to think, okay, well, this is not some sort of alien technology. And by the way, this is in like 1987. And those, when I saw the description of the canisters of the tubes down there, the containers, I thought, well, those are for gas. That's maybe this NB gas stuff. And it's just the same kind of thing that was developed by the Sonora Air Club. And this is now just like the further technological development, late 70s, early 80s version of a human-derived flying saucers using a mixture of human-developed and alien-gifted technology. And right, it would certainly be, ultimately become this this ARV vehicle. And so that's what he said it was called, the Alien Reproduction Vehicle. And, this is weird, Cliff. I swear to God, there was a report or a story about 10 years ago of an annual report or a prospectus that was put out by one of the major defense contractors that actually had an ARV in it. And I can't find any references to that on the internet. So I'm thinking that I have a dream, that I dream this up, or, but I'm pretty sure that was the case. I've talked to a few people about it. Jay Widener is supposed to be looking for one, an example, but the bottom line really is these sort of clunky early looking flying saucers, I think would have possibly been a development of technology along the lines of maybe what T. Townsend Brown was working on in the 1920s and 30s, sort of a gravitational control system. But they also bear a striking resemblance to the descriptions of what the Sonora Air Club was working on. So I think the ARV was kind of a combination of human and alien technology put to use to create our version of a flying saucer. And again, I think, as I say in the book, I think that this is what we're seeing in the very famous space shuttle videos of the battle in space, the STS-48.
We want to talk about that in a minute. Fascinating.
Okay.
Now, I want to talk a little bit more. The guy who you refer to is Brad Sorensen, who actually went to this air show and saw a ARV and actually did, he reproduced it to his memory. And I guess the question I would have for you, Mike, is why aren't we using this technology now? Why hide that? I mean, if it has the ability to move craft like that, we could probably morph it into all kinds of other uses, couldn't we?
Well, I think, I think that we are. And again, the question is always, well, why the secrecy? Well, the secrecy is so we don't get too far ahead of ourselves too quickly. And so that we, we have an economy that's based on a certain steady kind of progress. You don't introduce revolutionary new technologies or, if you have, excuse me, Cliff, if you have flying saucer technology, then you're capable of producing energies that basically what it amounts to is free energy. And if you have free energy, you can't have an economy. You can't have a tier-based economy. So I think that this is something that I think that's the biggest reason why these things are kept secret, and also because the people that have the technology want to keep it for themselves and exploit, right, things for themselves. If you look at the curvature of the development of transportation speeds, basically, you look at how fast a horse could run, and then next comes a train, and then you cut the automobile, and then propeller airplanes, and then jet airplanes, and then rockets. You see this skyrocketing curve of technology, of transportation technology, that basically goes from about 1850 to about 1960. For 100 years, the curve goes straight up. But then if you believe if you believe what the public has been given, then we have, then basically that curve goes straight up for 100 years and then it completely flatlines for the next 70 years. Because according to that curve, we've not made any technological advances in transportation since the chemical rocket was developed in the 1960s. And that's just not possible. We must have made a breakthrough. I think the breakthrough we made was this ARV flying saucer technology, and for whatever reason, it's being kept under wraps.
Before we get into this space shuttle mission, STS-48, and the video that was shot, which really proves that we are using very powerful anti-gravity crafts, perhaps the ARVs, I want you to talk about the other secret space program, which was Project Horizon, which you outline in your book, which I have heard about missions to the to the moon, but you make it sound like this actually happened. Do you think it happened, Project Horizon? Let's talk a little bit about Project Horizon. I thought it was fascinating.
Well, Project Horizon was this idea that we were going to build literally hundreds of rockets. I mean, like 150 rockets of various types. And launch them to the moon. Put them into low Earth orbit, where we would assemble a space station, and then we would launch again these, basically like railroad cars or, the shipping containers, basically that kind of thing, rounded canisters type of shape. Shoot them to the moon, bury them partially or fully under the lunar surface using various tractors and equipment we would send there. And create a lunar base with up to a dozen different astronauts living on the moon, inside this artificial base that would be partially buried. And, when you look at the technology, it was feasible. It could have worked. It wouldn't have cost all that much money. But it was planned before we ever went with Apollo as the official manned mission to the moon. The idea was we're just going to do this as a military program. And there's no reason that couldn't have been done. Everything that was there that was going to be used was technologically achievable. But what's fascinating about it is that a key inclusion in the Project Horizon plans, which have been declassified recently, is when you look at them, they were planning on sending them up there with nuclear weapons, hand shoulder-mounted nuclear missiles. And the question is, who would we have been defending ourselves against? Well, the Russians, would the Russians have really attacked our base on the moon and risked starting World War III? Or was it, the question arises, was that for somebody else? Was that we were going to defend ourselves against possibly aliens coming in and harassing us? So you put all this together, and I don't conclude that we did build it. What I do conclude is that we certainly could have built it, and it could have been there for years and years. And of course, in the secret space program, there's always these stories of secret alien bases on the moon or secret Earth, human bases on the moon and on Mars. And, what was it? Somebody said when Hillary, collapsed at the 9/11 memorial, they said it would be, Jimmy Kimmel said it'd be a lot easier to poo-poo these conspiracy theories if they didn't keep coming true. And the conspiracy theory about us building the secret base on the moon, well, you look at Project Horizon and you've got data right there that says that there was a plan to build a human military base on the moon in the 1960s. And it was technologically achievable. So, I think it's like, it would be easy to dismiss it as a conspiracy theory if it wasn't for the fact that it kept, it comes true right in the pages of this report.
Yeah. I mean, I have to go back to something you said earlier. You said that there was an attempt to create, maybe this is before Apollo, you can give me the time frame on it, but to get to the moon, to get the technology that was there, were there astronomers that were looking at the surface of the planet and saw down ships or buildings or something? And is that why they wanted to go to the moon?
Well, no, I'm sure you could see evidence of ruins from, telescopic observations. And there's lots of stories about people, being told that there were alien bases on the moon and so on and so forth. And that were visible in very early mid-1960s photographs. But I think, that the people on the inside, they knew that the moon had been inhabited before by aliens. There's no question they knew that. And And again, here it gets into my previous book, which was Ancient Aliens and Secret Societies, which is, you know, where they get that information. And I think it's been passed down through the generations, through the ancient records of the Anunnaki and their visitations and stuff like that, that, you know, that the moon was a way station for them. And so I think that they knew at some other secret level, you know, deep in the bowels of power, that the, that they would find artifacts on the moon. I think they knew that. And I think that was kind of the gamble that Kennedy took, was that all that stuff was correct.
I mean, your former co-author, Richard Hoagland, gets into huge information about glass cathedrals and buildings and all kinds of very sophisticated structures on the moon.
Yeah, that's,
and I guess my question is, when did we must have discovered this a while ago with some, you know, heavy-duty telescopic views of the surface.
Well, you could, but I think it, you know, the thing is with telescopes, it's difficult to see this stuff because it's transparent unless the light hits it just right. And I think it was, I think that they probably knew a lot of this stuff was there. I don't think they had mapped it until we had sent a few probes to the moon. I mean, I think you can make a really strong argument. As I, in my book, Ancient Aliens on the Moon, I make the argument that Surveyor 4 actually crashed into this stuff on its descent to the lunar surface. And, you know, there's a lot of complexity, levels of complexity to this, that they knew that these glass structures were there. I don't think telescopes are the best way to observe them. But I think if you look at the history of transient lunar phenomenon, the best explanation for that is that you're looking at light that is reflecting off of these glass panes, these glass panels, and creating these kinds of effects. So, you know, that's why I think how NASA knew all this stuff. You know, it's interesting. People, when you talk about like the Apollo 11 landing to the lunar surface, which is always reproduced and it's so dramatic, you know, where they get this 1202 alarm and they don't know what it is. And, oh, it means that the computer's overloaded. Well, what people don't know is the reason the computer was overloaded on Apollo 11 is because Buzz Aldrin, the lunar module pilot, actually activated two radars on the lunar module when he was only supposed to activate one. The lunar module had a descent radar, which was to basically ping in front of the spacecraft what was below it. It also had a side-mounted rendezvous and docking radar to tell them how far away the Apollo command module was when they had the dock. And he turned both of them on when he was only supposed to turn one of them on, and it overloaded the computer. And, of course, the reason he did that is because they wanted to get the complete radar coverage all around the spacecraft to make sure they didn't run into any of this stuff 20 or 30 miles above the lunar surface.
So
and that's in Ancient Aliens on the Moon. So, you know, again, those are just facts, people, little things people don't know, but I'm like, why else would he turn on the radar? He turned it on because they were very concerned they were going to splat against this stuff just the way Surveyor 4 had.
Interesting. That's just so fascinating. I've seen, and I can't verify they're real or not, photos on the internet of what appears to be ruins on Mars from, in fact, you and some of your books, Ancient Aliens on Mars, the Moon, show various very old, what looks like Byzantine pyramids and structures on the moon, which I find was fascinating, which makes you think about, okay, where do these come from? What's the history of them? How many years are they old and things like that? Let's move forward. There's so much in this book, but we want to move forward. And you hinted on the actual visualization of an what appeared to be an ARV, an alien reproduction vehicle, on a space shuttle mission. And you hinted upon it. It's STS-48 and STS-80, where the shuttle actually had its camera pointed to the Earth. And they capture very fast-moving objects moving up into the atmosphere and beyond. Can you describe these films and why they're so significant?
Yeah, if the listeners want to go out, and you can go to YouTube and you can see the full video of mission STS-48 and STS-80 to watch what I'm describing. But basically, if you haven't seen it, what STS-48 is that it's a space shuttle that's flying along, heading towards Australia, on an orbit. I think it's I forget which orbit it is, but it's basically shooting out the back of the space shuttle. And, you know, you see the Earth's horizon and you see the stars in the sky. And then there's these little objects kind of moving around in different patterns. And all of a sudden, one pops up over the horizon, travels at a very high rate of speed to the left. And then there's a bright flash on the left side of the screen. It makes a, I don't know, about a 45-degree angle turn. Mm-hmm. With an accelerates to about what would be about a 200,000 G turn, which is like kind of the equivalent of dropping a 10-story building on top of you. And she scoots off into space. And then you see two projectiles, missiles of some kind, weapons firing at this object and another object that's floating around. And there's been all kinds of debates about this for years. The bottom line is that all the attempts to debunk it are complete nonsense. They say the flash is a Vernier rocket. I showed this video just about a month ago at the MUFON OC meeting, and Blaine Hammond, who was a space shuttle pilot, astronaut, that flew the shuttle on numerous missions, was there. And I said, Blaine, you know, what do you think of that? He goes, no. He goes, the reaction control thrusters never look like that. I don't know what that flash is, but it's nothing from the space shuttle. And at the time, the shuttle itself was right over the Pine Gap installation in Australia. So I think what you're looking at is you're looking at a test of probably a railgun type system, weapon system, against these alien reproduction vehicles. You're looking at a low Earth orbit test of our alien reproduction vehicles versus our best at that time Star Wars developed weapons. And
a laser weapon of some kind.
Yeah, and I mean, the turn it makes is so dramatic and so intense, and it would have killed anybody on board the craft, but apparently it was piloted. The other issue is that Dr. Jack Kashner of the University of Nebraska has done research on the video, and he says that the object in question comes to a complete stop for about half a second before it makes its 45-degree angle turn. Now, what that means in simple terms is that it was a powered vehicle. The people that claim these are ice crystals are just full of it. There's no way it could be ice crystals. It, in fact, is a powered vehicle that actually makes a complete stop and performs maneuvers in space. And then you have the STS-80 footage, which is even more fascinating, that shows an object. They're flying over Santiago, Chile. There's this weird thing that looks like a tadpole that shoots up out of the ground and into space, and that's really weird. And then all these other objects appear in the field of view.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, this one main object comes in from right to left on the screen, hits the atmosphere. It flares up as electrostatic charge as it enters the atmosphere. Then it kind of keeps pace with the shuttle. It station keeps same position for a while, and then it slowly goes back the way it came. And again, I asked Blaine. I said, Blaine, you know, is this not a powered moving vehicle? And he said, it's exactly what it is. So I think what we're looking at is we're looking at actual footage of our ARVs that our secret space program has developed over the years, being tested in low Earth orbit and filmed by the space shuttle. And I also asked, well, wouldn't the astronauts have seen this? And he said, no, we'd be in the front crew cabin doing our tasks, doing our business. We aren't going to necessarily be looking at the back of the shuttle and what's being filmed. So this could have all happened without the astronauts seeing any of it.
Yeah, I don't want to get into James Oberg's defending that it's nothing, but it seems that he does pop up when there are questions.
An actual space shuttle pilot who just saw this footage with me a couple weeks ago, 100% debunks and disagrees with what Fatty Oberg has to say. Simpy, as I like to call him.
That's pretty funny because to have an actual astronaut view that and make comments really kind of verifies the fact that it is something that he doesn't know about, but it is not what Oberg says, which is lights and reflections and things like that.
James Oberg is besides being a bloated sack of protoplasm, is a disinformation agent, period. That's his sole job, is to disinform people. That's what he's up to.
I guess we have to deal with this, and this happens with the American government as well as other governments. Some governments are more open than others, but if we do have advanced, and it appears that we do have advanced propulsion technology, we're not going to hear about it. It's going to be classified and hidden and kept secret, I guess, forever, and until some other event comes about. And it's kind of frustrating because people like Stephen Greer believe that that propulsion system could be used for the betterment of man, and that we shouldn't be keeping it under wraps. So it's kind of frustrating.
Well, yeah, but I mean, again, it's these decisions are made at a higher pay grade than us. So, you know,
yeah.
I don't think anybody's going to really worry about what Stephen Greer thinks about all this.
Exactly.
So, you know, I think a lot of these guys get in our community, they're being kind of being used by the higher level people to, you know, keep further their own agenda. And I don't, you know, that's why I kind of wrote this book. I just wanted to be clear about everything, what the evidence actually shows.
Right. In the last few minutes we have left, in this book, those of you who are listening, you got to get this book. It's filled with really important information. It's kind of a nice update on what NASA appears to be doing based on evidence of these machines. But I'd like you to talk a little bit about this SERPO story, which I didn't know about. And apparently there was a second crash other than the Roswell crash. This crash was in the Pelona Mountains of New Mexico, and they captured an alien who was recovered. This individual, this entity, according to the story, described where he came from. There was a diplomatic relationship developed between his planet and Earth. And one thing led to another. And Mike, why don't you take it from there and talk about this incredible story, because I couldn't believe it myself.
Well, the Project SERPO website's been up since like 2005. And, you know, I'm just to start out, I mean, before I tell you the story, one of the things that I use in determining the veracity of something is, you know, you look at the MJ-12 documents. Some people say the MJ-12 documents are fake, that they're a hoax. Other people say that Project SERPO's website is a hoax. But here's the thing. The purpose of a hoax is to basically put it out there, get people to believe it, spread it around, and then you jump out and say, ha, 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 I made the whole thing up. Look at how clever I am. Look at how much smarter than you I am. I fooled you. Now, here we are with Project SERPO. 11 years later, there are volumes of information on SERPO.org. And by the way, that's S-E-R-P-O, folks, SERPO.org. Volumes and volumes and volumes of information. And in all of this information, it goes on and on and on with incredible levels of detail. And it's 11 years later, and the person who spent all of these many thousands of hours to supposedly create all this information and put it out there hasn't taken credit for it yet. If it's a hoax, no, folks, it's not a hoax. It's either one of two things. Either it's genuine information coming from government insiders, or it is disinformation, which also tells you something. If you have disinformation, it tells you the government is interested in getting people to not believe in UFOs by creating hoaxes. So my conclusion is that it must be for real, because people haven't ever taken credit for the so-called hoax. If it's a hoax, it just doesn't ever seem to, you know, doesn't ever seem to nobody ever seems to come out and take credit for it. So what this describes is that there was a crash of a second flying saucer after Roswell, that there was a survivor, that the survivor was a representative of a species that are very similar to the grays, that are called the Ebens. And that they live on a planet that is codenamed SERPO by the U.S. government, and that in the 1960s, after several fits and starts, there was a diplomatic arrangement reached between the United States government and the Ebens to send representatives. We were going to send 12 representatives to their planet to see what life was like there and study their culture, and they were going to leave one or two back here for the same kind of thing, that we could talk to and deal with, and that this actual diplomatic exchange program took place, and that the last of the, I guess only 8 of the 12 returned. One or two died. Two chose to remain on SERPO because they preferred it to life on Earth, and the others came back, and eventually the last of them, I think, died in, I believe it was, they said it, he died in 1988. So, you know, and again, this is supposedly depicted by the these final scenes in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where, you know, 12 astronauts in the red jumpsuits get on board the alien mothership and travel to their planet. And that supposedly is. And there's, of course, there's the rumor that Reagan told Spielberg after Close Encounters was screened at the White House that, you know, that's a lot closer to the truth than you might know, Steve. supposedly that's the story. And it's fascinating as you go through it. There's even a briefing. There's a very, very long briefing, which I quote from quite a bit in the book, a brief briefing that was supposedly given to President Reagan in 1981. And it has this mysterious character called the caretaker, who was the, quote, caretaker of all this information, and describes to Reagan all these different alien species that are out there, including one or two that might be hostile. And the thing about it is, again, is the internal consistency of it is the different characters that are represented there, the various Reagan aides, you know, their personalities come out in this transcript, and Reagan's personality comes out. And it's like the way they did it with such detail that unless they were listening to an actual recording or transcribing an actual recording, you know, you wouldn't have got this depth. In other words, if this was a fake, somebody went to such great lengths to capture the character of the men in the room. And I think one of them was William Casey, and one of them, I suspect, was Mike Deaver, one of Reagan's closest aides. That, you know, it just it's beyond comprehension that anybody would go to that was basically pushing a hoax would go to that level of effort and detail. So I think it's more likely than not that the transcript is something legitimate of a briefing that President Reagan actually did receive.
That's pretty amazing. So would you say that there's more of this kind of thing going on? I mean, it's hard to – you don't know. It's all hearsay. But this alien visitation and reverse engineering, because, look, I mean, there are – we know about – we, you know, according to you, we have these reverse engineers, alien reproduction vehicles. But when you combine those with the actual true alien visitations, it begins a little to become a little confusing. And I mean, what the hell's going on? I guess it just keeps going on. You know, I mean, we keep seeing these things and we keep hearing reports. There's a huge industry of people writing books about UFOs and alien interactions, but who knows what's going on?
Well, it's not that huge, because if it was huge, I'd be rich. So it's not. So,
well, there's an ancient alien. I guess you appear on Ancient Aliens occasionally, but that thing's a monster.
Yeah, well, 45 or 50 times now, I would say. Yeah, so I've been on once in a while. But, you know, I guess the thoughts that I would have about that is that, you know, I think that we just don't know yet what there's no one answer to this. I think there's multiple different organizations on the earth that are studying or involved with this problem and dealing with it. And I think that they're kind of on their agendas are hidden, and the agenda of the aliens is hidden. And some of them are all about the positive. Some of them are kind of negative. And I just think we don't know the difference between the two yet. And, or at least if anybody does, they're probably lying. You know, one thing I can tell your listeners is that I think, as I've looked at it, if it's disc shaped, it's probably one of theirs. If it's shaped like a triangle, it's probably one of ours. Or as I like to put it, if it's shaped like a Dorito, it's probably one of ours.
That's so funny.
So, you know, I think that there's just different. There's no one truth, because nobody has the answer. And I think if anybody claims that they have the answer, they're just not telling the truth. I don't think anybody truly understands the totality of what's happening.
It's fascinating. The book's Hidden Agenda, NASA and the Secret Space Program. My guest today has been Mike Barra. Mike, it's been great to have you on the program. Just quickly, very quickly, what's the takeaway you want people to have from this book? You kind of just gave it up a second ago, but is there anything else I'm missing here that you would like to let people know the meaning of this book is for you, why you wrote it?
Well, why I wrote it is because I wanted to just get to the crux of what is verifiable. What proof do we actually have there is a secret space program? And that's what I tried to put in here is what's the best evidence that there has been and continues to be a secret space program. And that's what the book's about. It's the nuts and bolts. It's not fanciful claims of, you know, serving on the galactic Federation of Light Council and dealing with the blue avians from Andromeda and any of that stuff. It's what can we actually put our fingers on? And I think we can put our fingers on a substantial amount of evidence that there's been a secret space program for quite some time.
Fantastic. Yeah, I enjoyed the book. Much success on it. For those of you who live in the United States, Mike travels quite frequently to all kinds of not only UFO, MUFON, Mutual UFO Society groups, but he does a whole bunch of consciousness expos. He does a show up here that I co-produce called New Living Expo in San Francisco.
Yep, great conference.
He does Conscious Life in L.A. And so he's out there, and it's great to have him speak first person on these issues because it's confusing. It's very confusing, and we don't know what to believe. Every bit of information that is clarified helps. So here's this new book. So, hey, much success, Mike. We hope you do well on this.
Thanks, Cliff. I appreciate it, and I will see you no later than April, I guess.
We'll see you in April. Fantastic.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Bye. So that was Mike Bera, and got to get this book. You can get it. It just came out. You can get it on Amazon. I think it's like $14, and it's quite interesting. If you haven't read his very first book, Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA, it's huge. It's like 500 pages, but it gets into quite a bit of information that we talked about on this program. And I think those of you who are wondering where that fits in with the Earth Ancient theme, it's my belief that we had technology in the distant past, different civilizations that actually were able to reach out into space, into other planets. I bring up Mars quite a bit because I discovered evidence of a society that was probably, or a culture that was probably forefathers of the Egyptian group that eventually came to the Earth. And I say that because they have discovered not only one, but a couple of different sphinx, and they've discovered pyramids and pyramidal-shaped buildings. And then next week, by the way, our program is going to be featured on Mars, called The Ruins of Mars with Dr. Brandenburg, George Haas, and two other special guests. We're going to do a round robin to talk about the latest research. And you can't poo-poo these things anymore. The photographic evidence is so crisp and so clear that it's pretty much black and white, short of sending people to the planet. And we will be doing that in the coming years. So stay tuned for that. I hope you're having a great holiday and you enjoyed your turkey. We'll look forward to hearing from you and checking in next week. Make sure you go to the Earth Ancients website. Register. If you haven't registered yet, register on the website, earthancients.com. Register. We'll get our monthly newsletter. Also, Gaia is offering a special program. Our sponsor at gaia.com/earthancients. Has a special startup program, 99 cents. You get hundreds of first-time, high-quality programming that you can view in the comfort of your home. Mike just mentioned his program that's on there. There's a whole bunch of other fantastic people. If you want to know more about the subject matter featured here on the program, go to gaia.com, Earth Ancients, and click through, go to reference, and just punch in what you want to watch, and a whole bunch of material will come up. So check it out, gaia.com, Earth Ancients. All right, we'll see you next time.